Mexico exploded into violence after a powerful drug lord was killed. Germany is busy bringing the world together against America. The war in Ukraine has entered its fifth year. And it's not just Iran that could be on the brink of war. Ethiopia may shortly explode as well. We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Dozens of people have been killed after one of Mexico's most powerful drug lords was killed by security forces. Where is it leading? Will the blowback hit the United States? To find out what's going on here, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Mexico is basically on the verge of civil war. It's one of those nations to where its drug cartel problem is so bad that the cartels collectively actually control about 40% of Mexican territory, have close to 200,000 soldiers working for them. And so when you're looking at clashes between the Mexican government and the cartels, this isn't something that's just about routine law enforcement or cracking down on gangs. It's to a level where it's basically like civil war conditions where you're going up against these powerful criminal syndicates with their own private army. And that's what happened at the beginning of this week. The United States military intelligence has been tracking cartel leaders, particularly the leaders of the Jalisco New Generation cartel. This is a relatively new cartel in Mexican history, centered around the city of Jalisco. And it, unlike the older, more, I guess, traditional cartels like the Sinaloa cartel, which mostly farm marijuana or poppies or other things that you can make into hard drugs. The Jalisco cartel imports chemical precursors from China and is big in the fentanyl trade. Donald Trump, obviously, I mean, he's talked a lot about cracking down on the fentanyl trade in America. So the U.S. military intelligence has been tracking the leader of this cartel. And then this week, in collaboration with the Mexican government, killed the leader. His nickname in Mexico is El Menco. They were actually, the plan was to arrest him, but the firefight between his bodyguards and the Mexican military grew pretty intense. He ended up getting shot several times and dying while being airlifted to Mexico City. And so that obviously prompted the cartel to seek revenge, putting spikes in roads, burning buses in roads, burning banks, killing several dozen people. You see any news footage of the region, you just like huge smoke plumes. A lot of cities have been put on lockdown, or at least were on lockdown, for a good part of the week as the government tries to decide where to go from here. Now, several years ago, they did something similar with the son of the leader of the Sinaloa cartel. And the violence got so bad that the Mexican government just ended up releasing him and backing down. In this case, they haven't backed down yet. I actually heard another report just recently of another senior member of the Jalisco New Generation cartel who was killed in the firefights between the Mexican military and the cartels. But definitely, both Mexico and the world are very interested in how bad this is going to get. It's a unfortunate situation in Mexico to where the government generally kind of goes back and forth between fighting wars against the cartels till the death toll hits war zone levels. And then backing off, which when they back off, the death toll does come down. But the cartels get stronger. So under George W. Bush, the U.S. and the Mexican government like waged an all-out war on the cartels. The cartels fought back. Like 40,000 people died. I think for a while the death toll in Mexico was worse than in the Syrian civil war. Then Barack Obama instituted a new policy where instead of fighting all the cartels, the U.S. government, and we know this from many drug cartel whistleblowers, the U.S. government more or less made an informal partnership with the Sinaloa cartel, saying that we'll allow Sinaloa to traffic drugs as long as they don't traffic people and counterfeit money, and as long as they help us keep the other cartels down. Under the previous Mexican president, Andre Lopez Manuel Obrador, he had his famous Hugs Not Bullets campaign where he basically gave the cartels a free hand and saying that, well, we'll let you traffic drugs as long as you don't kill people. The current Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, a lot of people thought she would be similar to the previous Mexican president. Although this assassination this week indicates she may be willing to work with President Trump to take out some of these cartel bosses, which is a good thing. These men definitely need to be brought to justice. But it is definitely an action that comes with a price. In that, like, if you start assassinating cartel bosses are going to have their men start assassinating your people as well.
So, I mean, you mentioned everyone's wondering, where do we go from here? Like, what do you think? Is this the start of more violence from Mexico's drug cartels? Or is it more a case of the president of Mexico, she was kind of prodded out of her appeasement by Donald Trump, and she'll kind of go back to appeasement after this?
Probably the latter. I'd say it's definitely accurate that, like, Claudia Sheinbaum, she is like the protege of Lopez Obrador, and so she follows a lot of his policies. I feel like she did take some prodding from the Trump administration to agree to this strike, and has made some statements since indicating that the Mexican government does not want all-out war with the cartels like they declared back in 2006. So this current rioting and fight with the cartels, it may go on for a while. I think it will calm back down again. But it definitely cast a spotlight on how powerful the cartels are in Mexico. Even Donald Trump, when he was talking about this, he indicated that the Mexican president is terrified of the cartels, and has some good reason to be, realizing that, like, if you declare war on this, this is going to be like civil war-like conditions in Mexico. And tying this back into Bible prophecy, our last trumpet print edition really focused in on a verse in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, talking about a curse that will come on America if they turn away from God, particularly that they will be besieged in all their gates until their high and fenced walls come down. Our editor-in-chief has mentioned several times that the besiegement in all your gates is more about international trade war. Foreign nations, European Union, China, Mercosur, teaming up against the United States and freezing them out of that world trade. But that second part of that verse about your high and fenced walls coming down is more about immigration, or particularly like foreign nations sending soldiers into the United States. And that's been applied to the border crisis that got so bad under Joe Biden. Now, Donald Trump, at least temporarily, has secured that southern border, But when you see the strength of some of these drug cartels, you really do get a glimpse into how bad this prophecy will be if America doesn't repent and it actually comes to its ultimate fulfillment. And there is an international trade siege against America, and our border security breaks down. And you've got these drug cartel agents pouring into America. And then you'll have the type of violence you're seeing in Jalisco this week in U.S. cities. Because there's many, I mean, there's thousands of drug cartel agents in the United States already. This number might be a little old. It was a while ago I calculated it, but I know as of a couple years ago, about 55% of homicides in Mexico were drug-related, and 7% of homicides in the United States were drug-related. So some of this drug-related violence is already spilling into the United States. And like from a moral perspective, like I said, these drug cartels exist and are so powerful because they're trafficking Chinese precursor chemicals and South American cocaine and other hardcore drugs into the United States because there's a demand for it in the United States. Which means there's a spiritual problem in the United States that people are trying to fill with these hardcore drugs from Mexico. And this problem, it's already destroying Mexico. But these prophecies in Deuteronomy 28 reveal that if America doesn't like repent of this spiritual problem, it will eventually destroy the United States as well as this violence moves north. Donald Trump's trying to slow that down with border security, but that border security will only hold so long as the American people themselves give millions and even billions of dollars in some estimates to these Mexican cartels, empowering them to the point where the Mexican government, it's not necessarily that they don't want to take down the drug cartels, so much as that, and like in Claudia Sheinbaum's case, she's afraid that she can't. Like, she's logistically unable to. They're that powerful.
Thank you for that. And a pretty shocking glimpse into what could well be the future of the United States, even in what happened there in Belgium. What else do you have for us from the English-speaking world?
Well, we've got an update on President Trump's tariffs. Last week, it was actually breaking news that the Supreme Court had ruled President Trump's tariffs under the 1977 Emergency Powers Act unconstitutional. Couldn't give you too many details in the program last week because I had not read the majority opinion. I've since done so. It basically boiled down to this wasn't like a landmark constitutional case ruling that the chief executive of the United States can't impose tariffs on foreign nations. It was rather a much more narrow and targeted Supreme Court case saying that the specific act that Congress passed in 1977 enabling the president of the United States to regulate trade during a national emergency does not enable him to put taxes on the American people. So in other words, Donald Trump said that there were two national emergencies. One, China, Canada, and Mexico were trafficking fentanyl into the United States. And two, foreign competition was hollowing out America's industrial base. Therefore, he put a 25% tariff on China, Canada, and Mexico, and a 10% tariff on almost everybody else. In that case, the Supreme Court's ruled that the president could use that 1997 act to put a trade embargo on Canada, Mexico, China, or other nations. But he did. But the act doesn't actually give him the power to make American people pay taxes on goods they buy from those countries. It would enable him to say American people can't buy goods from those countries, but it doesn't enable him to say they have to pay taxes on those countries. So long story short, President Trump accepted the decision and imposed a 10% global tariff on all nations under like Section 122 of the 1972 Trade Act. So there's still global tariffs. That now that particular act, the Supreme Court hasn't made any rulings on it yet, and if I don't know if it will, and if it would, it would be months from now. But unless it's extended by Congress, you're only supposed to be able to use it for about 5 months. So it gives President Trump a way to keep tariffs on pretty much everybody for the next 5 months, and then figure out what he wants to do after that. And those tariffs have already been enacted.
Which I've also heard he could just suspend it for a day and then reenact those same tariffs again and extend it for another set of months, which would be challenged by the court. But by the time a court gets around to actually issuing it a definitive ruling, whatever stopgap that he's worked on would be in place. So it would get him past.
Another couple big economic stories. We've got one. We've got the CEO of JP Morgan Chase out warning that basically financial conditions in America today are very similar to financial conditions before the 2008 economic crash and Great Recession. So he's warned about the national debt before. Right now he's not talking about the national debt. Right now he's just talking about private individuals just leveraging a lot of money and getting themselves in a position where if there was an economic downturn, they'd have too much debt to say sustainable. And so warning that another big economic crash is on the horizon, which is really significant because I feel like a lot of President Trump's economic policies with his big, beautiful bill and other things are things that like they're only going to work if like you keep the treasury bond like 4.4% or under the treasury yields. But a big economic crisis could be shaping things up quickly. So really sobering report. You'd think America would have learned more lessons from the 2008 economic crash, and it looks like they have not. And so I think we can say with the backing of Bible prophecy that another great recession is coming soon. We don't know exactly when, but the financial investors in America are borrowing enough money that they seem to be hurling towards that disaster. And one other story I'll say real quick, just because I thought it was so ridiculous, is that New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani has teamed up with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to invite the people of New York City to enroll their children in basically free preschools. But the which is definitely goes along with Mamdani's socialist agenda. The interesting thing about this particular ad, though, is they specified that the people of New York should enroll their children in these free preschools regardless of their immigration status. And so, like, the idea of, like, giving an ad in Spanish saying enroll your children in free preschool regardless of your immigration status is basically an invitation to illegal immigrants, saying that, like, if you're here illegally, Donald Trump may be trying to deport the illegals, but New York City not only is a sanctuary city, but we're actually going to use taxpayer dollars to make sure that you don't have to pay for your children's schooling. So really just another sign of just how much, even though Donald Trump is working hard to secure the southern border, his rivals in the Democratic Party are doing everything as possible to encourage illegal immigrants to come here and make their life as comfortable as possible on U.S. taxpayer dime.
And while we're talking about the English-speaking world, I'll just add in one from England from this morning, where the Green Party has shocked the nation by winning a by-election for a seat in Parliament that the Labour Party has held since 1931. So for nearly 100 years, they had a really commanding lead just 2 years ago, the last time they had an election. And the Green Party have won the seat. And basically, the Green Party are kind of like Queers for Palestine, the party. It's a marriage between socialism and the far left, and then also radical Islam and trying to appeal to the Muslim vote at the same time. So they've been very openly out there going after the Muslim vote. They have, well, the party, they're trying to put something, they're in the process of putting something in their official platform saying that Zionism is racist, that it's a racist ideology. They also want it in their official, or they're working on having it in their official party platform, that the state of Israel should not exist. They should be replaced not by a two-state solution, but a one-state Palestinian solution. There should just be one Palestinian state. And they put out election material in Urdu, the language of Pakistan, and it was all about showing Labour politicians meeting with India's Narendra Modi or Benjamin Netanyahu. The idea being they're trying to appeal to all these Pakistani immigrants, saying don't vote for these guys, you know, they meet with your enemies. And this is the kind of tribal politics that we're used to seeing in the third world, and this is for an election in Manchester. At the same time, the number two party was the Reform Party. So Labour and Conservative, Britain's equivalent of Republicans and Democrats, were in third and fourth place. Conservatives were about 2% of the vote. They've been completely eclipsed. It's a stunning scale of change in Britain. But Melanie Phillips wrote this morning, Britain is now facing a red, black, green alliance. The left, the Muslims, and the revolutionary, West-hating, Zionophobic Greens versus Reform and the Conservatives, who are trying to destroy each other and thus risk wiping out in the process the defense of Britain and the West. It's what might reasonably be thought a cultural and political emergency, otherwise known as chickens coming home to roost with a bang. And, you know, as we talk about on this show, you've brought this up, Andrew, Hosea 7 and verse 8 talks about strangers have devoured his strength and he knows it not. And the fact that Britain's got such a complete mess of politics, thanks to large-scale immigration, is a massive example of that. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. The war in Ukraine is entering its fifth year. We've had 4 years now of Vladimir Putin being right on the brink of victory or right on the brink of being ousted from power, depending on who you read. 4 years of new developments in war, of a lot of drone fighting, huge explosion in the amount of drones on the battlefield, with things like AI targeting data and electronic warfare. 4 years, sadly, of death and destruction for Ukraine. Here to tell us more about it and where we're going to go from here, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. It was 4 years ago this week, in the early hours of February 24th of 2022, that missiles streaked across the sky. Artillery fire shattered the silence as Russian forces struck cities across Ukraine. And of course, at the same time, you had tens of thousands of Russian troops pouring across the borders in the darkness before the sun rose that day in this sweeping four-pronged attack. And we know that Russian President Vladimir Putin, he thought that he could quickly capture Ukraine, much in the way he had seized the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine 9 years earlier. He thought that it would be a lightning strike, seizing Kyiv, collapsing the Ukrainian command structure, toppling its leadership, and forcing a political settlement before the world really even had time to react. He thought that it could all be accomplished perhaps in just a few days. And really, it wasn't just the Russians who thought that it would go very quickly. Most of us, myself included, thought that Russia, with what was branded as the world's second most powerful military, would quickly prevail. But the problem was Ukraine refused to follow the script that the Russians had kind of written for them. You know, here we are 4 years later, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is still in Kyiv. Ukrainian forces continue to fiercely contest every kilometer of battlefield. Russia has failed to capture even a single one of Ukraine's regional capitals. And the will of the Ukrainian people has hardened like iron. What began as a lightning assault 4 years ago has slowed to just this brutal war of endurance, one that is not measured any longer in days, but now in years. So it's just grinding on with as many as 1,000 casualties now per day. 1,000 per day, people who are, you know, either killed or maimed. So just a brutal tragedy. And many in the West have been saying that the strain on the Russian economy is unsustainable, and that Russia will soon falter, that its system will fracture, and that Putin himself will be swept aside. But the truth is, Putin has shown himself to be very resilient in this war. He has convinced his people that it's an existential war for Russia, that if they don't win it, Russia will, you know, be no more. He has also transformed Russia thoroughly into a war economy, and he has deepened his partnerships with North Korea and China and Iran. And these partners are just propping Russia up economically and sending Putin vast amounts of weaponry and even sending soldiers in the case of North Korea. So with all these methods, Putin is defying all the forecasts about a Russian collapse, and he's keeping the war raging week after week, month after month, and here, you know, year after year, we can now say too. And biblical prophecy actually shows that Putin is only just getting started. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote an article in early 2022, just when Russia expanded this conflict into a full-scale war. This article is called "Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Ukraine." And he wrote in there about how Putin's aggression is something that he has been warning and sounding the alarm about for decades. One part of this article says, "I have been warning for years that Vladimir Putin would be responsible for violent conquests and would set in motion some astonishing historic events." And then Mr. Fleury explains that the reason why he has been warning about Putin is because of biblical prophecy. One of the main passages that he examines there is Ezekiel chapter 38, which is a chapter largely about an individual called the Prince of Rosh. And Mr. Fleury identifies this individual as Vladimir Putin. And these passages show how this so-called Prince of Rosh or Prince of Russia will soon be fighting wars far larger and far more cataclysmic than the current one against Ukraine. So this article from 2022, it still has a lot of ongoing relevance, and I would recommend it to any listener who would like to understand Russia's war in the big picture context. Once again, it's called "Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Ukraine."
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Do you have any, I mean, that's a great long-term perspective, and maybe that is all that we can really be sure of. Do you have any thoughts as to how this could progress in the more medium term, like how this war might come to a conclusion?
I imagine it'll be a negotiated settlement of some kind. But it's hard for me to envision Russia stopping until they absolutely have to. At this point, Vladimir Putin feels that his political survival is tied to, if not a Russian victory, then at least the war continuing. If it were to end right now without him even having captured any of Ukraine's regional capital cities there in the east, it's hard to see how he could sell that to his people there in Russia as something other than a very expensive failure for the nation. So I don't think that peace is on the horizon anytime soon unless Russia faces a lot more economic strain. And right now you have the Trump administration trying to alleviate the strain on Russia. So we'll see how it goes.
I mean, recently we had that news story about Starlink making it so that Russian soldiers and the Russian military in Ukraine couldn't access their technology. And I saw headlines and I saw articles saying that this was a massive moment for Ukraine, that they'd been able to take back a whole lot of territory. I also know, though, that a lot of Western media, they're cheerleading for one particular side, and so they succumb to wishful. They tend to succumb to wishful thinking and let what they want to happen be what they report too often. Was that a significant setback for Putin, or is that being exaggerated?
I think in the short term, the decision by Elon Musk and SpaceX to terminate Russia's access to the Starlink system was a notable setback for Russia. And the Ukrainians very quickly exploited it, and they were able to make some significant gains on the battlefield. I think it was perhaps a couple of hundred square kilometers of territory that they captured over the last month or so because of that Russian disruption. But I don't think that it's anything that the Russians won't be able to pretty quickly come back from. I think in the medium term, they'll find other options, and that this vulnerability that the Ukrainians have been exploiting will pretty quickly be kind of filled.
Well, thank you for that update and that context. What else do you have for us from the Asia region?
Yes, another story here about China that's actually also related to the Starlink system. We know that the Chinese unlawfully claim ownership over almost the entire South China Sea. And they use all kinds of bullying tactics in the waters there against the vessels from the nations that these waters actually legally belong to, countries like the Philippines and Vietnam and Indonesia and Brunei. Well, this week, though, there was a new tactic from the Chinese, and that was using some sort of unknown technology to disrupt the Starlink internet connection of several Philippine Coast Guard vessels. This was inside of some Philippine waters near the Scarborough Shoal. And every time certain Chinese vessels would get within a few miles of these Philippine Coast Guard ships, their signals were suddenly disrupted. And that disruption delayed the transmission of information. It compromised their comm systems. So it's a new tactic from China, but it's pushing toward that same old goal of antagonizing and just intimidating the vessels of other nations, in hopes that they will soon have full control over the South China Sea. And then I have just one final story here about who the greatest person in the world is. Many of us have probably wondered from time to time who it is, but this week, this question was decisively answered in an important announcement. It turns out that the greatest person in the world is Kim Jong-un, the supreme leader of North Korea. I should add, though, that this announcement comes from North Korean state propaganda, which is controlled by Kim Jong-un. So it comes from an editorial in the nation's largest newspaper, The Workers' Daily. So there could be potentially a little bit of a conflict of interest there, perhaps the possibility of a little bit of bias. But this editorial claims that Kim Jong-un has made, quote, unimaginable achievements that have made North Korea just a paragon of power and prosperity. It also says that Kim Jong-un has personally worked three miracles, including saving a lot of people from a flood in North Korea. So the proof is all there, according to Kim Jong-un's newspaper, that Kim Jong-un is, quote, the greatest person in the world.
Well, that shouldn't be too surprising. I guess in 2012, he was voted the sexiest man alive.
It's true, yeah. The accolades for Kim Jong-un, there's no end to them.
I think that was one. I vaguely remembered something, so I looked it up just now, where the Onion, the satirical newspaper, named him that, and then Chinese People's Daily, a Chinese government-run organization, didn't realize that the Onion was a joke news source and reported on it as if it were fact. So it says something about North Korean propaganda that it ends up accidentally overlapping with satire, which I guess extreme propaganda often does. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Germany is uniting the world against America. That's the cover article for our latest Trumpet print. And a couple of news stories from this week tie right into that. So first of all, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz had his first trip to China that signaled a pretty abrupt change in relations between Germany and China. He was greeted with full military honor. He took a private tour of the Forbidden Palace, showered with accolades. They went to watch autonomous robots do martial arts that looked pretty impressive, actually, much better than I've seen Chinese autonomous robots do before. Bild said that this was the biggest show of respect given to a Western leader since Donald Trump made the trip to China in 2017. And could well prove to be a very significant turning point. Under German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Germany and China developed a kind of special relationship. Merkel made more trips to China than to any other non-European country. Xi Jinping gave her special honors. He invited her over to the house where he grew up. You know, all these kind of signs of personal friendship. And then after that, things went off the rails a little bit or cooled down. You've had a lot of cheaper Chinese goods flood into Europe. It's been making life difficult for German car companies and a lot of other manufacturers. You had the war in Ukraine that we just heard about from Jeremiah, and China is very strongly sided with Russia. That's driven another wedge between China and a lot of European countries. And then you've had a lot of major European companies being forced to choose a side, United States or China. And a lot of them so far have chosen the United States. So Merz's trip was designed as a bit of a reset with compromise from both sides. And I think he very deliberately dropped a lot of the talk about human rights. He got rid of normally German leaders make a point of having questions from the media to kind of show off. We have a free media that's allowed to question our leaders. China doesn't have that. He dropped that. He did stand up strongly for Germany's trade interests, and he really pushed this, you know, you've got to stop taking advantage of us on trade, and here is where we think we are being unfair. And I think it's an interesting compromise they seem to have come to, where Germany has agreed, okay, we understand that you don't want us to talk about human rights, and you don't want us to talk about the millions of your own people in concentration camps, or a couple of million, and products made with slave labor, and lack of freedom of speech, and all of that. Yeah, okay, we will be quiet about that. But in return, you know, we want you to listen to our economic concerns, help our economic interests. And China seemed to do that. As a sign of a concession to this to Germany's trade concerns, China promised to buy 120 Airbus aircraft, and they're doing a lot more in terms of different trade deals. So I think this looks like it could be a turning point in the relationship between these two, and that's exactly what was on the cover of our trumpet about Germany uniting the world against America. That was Mr. Gerald Flurry's From the Editor piece there. And that commentary or that article that Mr. Flurry wrote specifically was about a Mercosur deal that Germany had signed with Latin America. So he was talking about Germany and Latin America and then how Germany would bring Asia in and was uniting the world against America. And we saw that on display this week. And you can, I spoke more about that on yesterday's Trumpet Daily Show. Mr. Flurry gave me the opportunity to guest host. You can go look that show up on YouTube or Rumble or on our website, thetrumpet.com. And you can listen to Mr. Stephen Flurry daily, focusing on the most important news of the day and often a bit of a Bible study at the end. Just a really wonderful, well-rounded program. So that was Germany and China. But then we had another major milestone on this Mercosur deal, because Germany or Europe and Latin America, they worked for about 30 years to finally get this deal signed. Then all kinds of European countries threw up problems. So they chopped the deal in half and they put the more controversial parts in one half. And they got the half that they did like passed and agreed and passed the right number of different countries. It then had to just be signed off by the European Parliament. And they kicked it into the long grass. And they said, we're not sure this is legal. We need an opinion from the European Court of Justice, I think it was, or one of those different European courts. That can take time. That typically takes, I think, at least a year. And so this was very clearly delaying tactics from those countries that do not like this deal. Just this week, I think even just today, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said that we're going to implement it anyway. So she called it the most consequential trade agreement of the first half of this century and said, you know, therefore, we're going to move forward. We're going to implement it provisionally before the summer, before we hear back from the courts as to whether or not it is legal, before it's through the European Parliament. Now, France is furious about this. The French President Emmanuel Macron called this decision a bad surprise. He said, I will never defend an agreement that is lax on imports and tough on what we produce at home because it is inconsistent for European consumers and because it is criminal for European sovereignty. You know, he really doesn't like it. But it's going ahead. Germany wants this. This is about Germany bringing the world together against America. And going back to that cover article, Mr. Fleury wrote, with so much happening in the world, most Americans are paying little attention to this trade agreement. But I guarantee they won't be able to ignore it indefinitely. This deal will impact the whole world. It's going to affect your life dramatically. The seeds are being sown for a trade war and an economic siege that will help destroy America. This trade deal is that important. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of will in Europe to get that done. So again, you can see his article, Germany Unites the World Against America, in our latest Trumpet print edition. And we'd be very happy to send you a free copy of that every time it comes out, 10 times a year. You can have it come straight into your mailbox. You can sign up for that on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you have any difficulties doing that, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Well, a few other quick stories from Europe. Germany's Parliamentary Budget Committee approved a major order for combat drones, largely from German defense startups Helsing and Stark Defense. It's about $500 million in terms of drones, but it can be extended with parliamentary approval. And a lot of these are going to be going to the German brigade in Lithuania. They want that to be really cutting edge and have a lot of drones. So they're moving forwards on that front. Again, like we kind of alluded to briefly, I think the war in Ukraine have really shown people the value of drones in warfare. Last week, the German police announced they are investigating a man for the heinous crime of calling German Chancellor Friedrich Merz Pinocchio on Facebook. There's a clause in Germany's criminal code that can impose up to 5 years in prison for those found guilty of insulting or gossiping, or with malicious gossip, I guess I should say, about people in public life. And this is something that the German government has been stepping up. It's policing of speech. And there's Friedrich Merz is pushing a new law that would remove anonymity on the internet, make it much easier for Germany to crack down on citizens. And you know, there's a whole lot that could be construed as criticizing speech, or criticizing leaders. You voice some disagreement with a particular policy. You say that somebody has done something bad, something evil. You could find the police at your door. That's where Germany is heading. It shows, you know, it exposes the spirit that is rising in the Holy Roman Empire in Europe there. And then we've also had several stories recently about Europe moving into Africa. France and Algeria have agreed to resume security cooperation. Earlier this month, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni was visiting Ethiopia for the second Italy-Africa summit. German companies launched 5 new partnerships with East African companies. The German foreign minister in January made his first trip to Africa. So you see Germany trying, or Europe trying to move into this area. And it's an area that is, I saw an article just today talking about how they're starting to grow a little bit tired of China. And for a long time, China has been their preferred partner because China will give them money and invest in countries who aren't democratic, and they won't lecture them about human rights the way that Europe and especially the United States will. So, you know, they've been doing business with China. Now they're starting to realize more and more that they're being exploited by China, and that when they started to get in bed with China, the expectation was that they'd be able to keep some of this wealth, and that some of the they're selling raw materials to China, things like cobalt and lithium, but that eventually some of the manufacturing with that cobalt and lithium would start to move into Africa. As China got wealthier and wealthier, well, then someone else and kind of move up the value chain, they'd get into more of what Apple does and designing things. And then you'd get your Africa getting more into manufacturing. That's not happening. And so they've been starting to stage protests. Even countries like Zimbabwe refusing to export things to certain shipments to China and protesting that way. So interesting to see Europe making a push for Africa at this time. Well, talking of Africa and talking specifically of Ethiopia, it's a country that fought a civil war very recently, and civil war could be back on the agenda. So to talk about this and its prophetic ramifications, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, recent reports suggest that the 21st century's deadliest conflict could restart any day now. This is speaking about Ethiopia and their war against the Tigray minority in the north. They fought a civil war between each other between 2020 and 2022, where an estimated 600,000 to 800,000 people died. It's, by death toll, the largest conflict of this century. And unconfirmed reports suggest that both sides are getting ready for round two. Isolated reports suggest that Ethiopia is undergoing a mass mobilization against the Tigray, including withdrawing soldiers from the Amhara region, which it itself has been experiencing unrest for a number of years now. So whatever's going on there is serious. And the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the main militia in Ethiopia, has reportedly signed an alliance with Sudan, Ethiopia's neighbor to the north, Eritrea, another neighbor that has a long history of war with Ethiopia, and other militias for action against Ethiopia. The Institute for the Study of War, a fairly respected think tank, summarizes this, quote, "The Ethiopian federal government will likely launch an offensive against the Tigray People's Liberation Front within the next month," which is not a lot of time. And again, this was this century's so far deadliest conflict, with crimes like ethnic cleansing, mass killings on both sides. The Ethiopian government has been implicated even in using chemical weapons. And so this would be a humanitarian catastrophe and disaster if it were to hit just by itself. But Ethiopia is also an extremely strategic country as well. They control the source of most of the water of the Nile River, and Egypt has had a lot of squabbles with Ethiopia over the years on control of that water. It borders Somalia. It has problems of radical jihadism like Somalia, with some of the same groups. And it has a population of 110, 120 million. The exact count isn't certain, but if there was a crisis to send even a fraction of that as refugees, the refugee crisis coming from Africa to Europe has already caused a lot of problems. This would compound that. So there is a lot of tension right now going on in Ethiopia that could potentially destabilize many different countries.
Now, like you said, this was a pretty massive war. It's also one that we read relatively little about in the media and saw nothing about really on TV news. Why do we pay such close attention to this while so many others don't?
Well, the big reason for that, like everything else we talk about, is because it factors into Bible prophecy. We cover on this program repeatedly of the prophecy on Daniel 11, verse 40, that talks about a clash between a king of the north and the king of the south. And Mr. Fleury has consistently pointed to radical Islam led by Iran and its proxy empire as the fulfillment of the king of the south, which is why we expect Iran to grow in power, which is why we expect Iran to increase its influence. But Iran won't be the only country that goes to war with the king of the north or with Europe. Verses 42 to 43 show some of the countries that the king of the north will attack along with the king of the south, implying those countries are all allies. Quote, "He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps," end quote. And because of that, Mr. Fleury has said, watch for those countries, Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia, to fall to Iran. And of all those countries were mentioned, and even some other neighboring ones Mr. Fleury has brought up, Ethiopia is the outlier. It's not in the Middle East. It's a bit further south of that. It's a majority Christian country. And we at the Trumpet have had quite a bit of controversial comments coming in from people wondering how could Ethiopia possibly fall to Iran. Well, if you go back to the last war, the last round of the war, Iran was actually helping sponsor the Ethiopian government under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. They were giving him drones. They were continuing their trade with him, even as the rest of the world was looking at him as a pariah. And around the same time, you were also seeing radical Islamist activity. Al-Shabaab, the Somali terror group, they have a presence in Ethiopia, and they are against Ethiopia as well. So we don't necessarily know what the ins and outs of the near future are going to be with every little move. We don't know exactly how this prophecy is going to be fulfilled, but something like the deadliest conflict of the 21st century restarting in this critical part of the world would, in light of Bible prophecy, would certainly be something to keep an eye on. And Mr. Fleury goes into that and a lot more in his book, The King of the South, which you could put in a link in the show notes.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. What else do you have for us from Europe today? Not Europe, that's my region. What do you have from the Middle East today?
Just a little rundown of the latest updates on the face-off between the United States and Iran. The countries had nuclear negotiations in Switzerland yesterday, so I guess it is involving Europe in that sense. And what exactly they've discussed has been pretty mum. The U.S. had described the talks as positive, but haven't really gone beyond that. There's talks scheduled in Austria next week. But the feeling is if there was some sort of breakthrough, like President Trump has been indicating would be the reason for him to back down, we probably would have heard of something by now. And because of that, a lot of people think that President Trump's deadline on when he'll decide to attack Iran is coming up in a few days, and this meeting was seen as the last major opportunity for de-escalation, and looks like that's not happening. And we're seeing signs on the ground that something, that the U.S. may be planning something. Just today, U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, said that if there are any embassy staff, non-essential staff, that are planning on leaving because of the tensions, that they do so immediately today. You also have the U.S. Air Force stationing aircraft in Israel, first time ever for preparation for a combat mission. Some U.S. officials have been telling Politico that the U.S. hopes Israel will attack Iran first, because if Iran retaliates, that would give maybe a more palatable reason for the U.S. to get directly involved. And even throughout the past week, we've been seeing actions from the Defense Department, from the State Department, withdrawing personnel from places like Lebanon, like Bahrain, like Qatar, in anticipation of something. So whatever's happening, it looks like the U.S. is planning for something, and this story could be updated by the time this episode even airs.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo, and to all of our contributors today. I'll conclude by encouraging you to sign up for our latest Trumpet Print subscription. Once again, we often mention books and booklets here, but for a bit of variety, you can mention or plug our Trumpet magazine that we have to write often several weeks in advance, but still so often ends up being very relevant, as the news from Europe this week shows, with even while Donald Trump is out there talking about the State of the Union and about how America is awesomer than ever, you have countries around the world getting together, conspiring to work to bring down the United States. That's exactly what the front cover of our Trumpet Print is all about. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read all of the articles yourself there as well, but we'd be very happy to get you that free print copy so that you can turn to those scriptures that we mentioned, prove this from yourself, from your Bible. Well, thank you very much as well to George Haddad for engineering and production. We will, later today, Andrew Miller has got a very interesting interview coming up that we hope to air next week if all goes well. So keep an eye out for that. And until then, keep watching your world.